We've been hearing about big companies using exploitative labor practices in order to cut costs for a long time, but usually the exploitation has occurred overseas in countries with far laxer labor laws. And the standard line from those companies is that they don't control foreign labor practices. Yet, a year-long USA Today Network investigation found that there are equally troubling and exploitative practices happening right here in the United States among port truckers in Southern California. And it started in a surprising and unexpected way. Brett Murphy, an investigative reporter with the USA Today Network, joins us now to talk about what he uncovered for his story, which was headlined, Rigged. Welcome to our show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How did you even find this story?
Well, it was when the longshoremen were striking on the West Coast almost 2 years ago, and I got talking to some truck drivers who were lining up. They weren't able to get into the docks to move some containers and get paid, so I was talking to these guys, and I kept hearing about how they were going to owe their boss money at the end of the week. Everyone kept telling me that they're going to be in the red. They're not going to take home any pay, and that got me asking some questions about what the actual business model was in this industry, and I was surprised to find out it was pretty prevalent.
So these are not union drivers?
Yeah, that's right. They're all independent contractors, or they're called independent contractors, and that's been a point of contention between the companies and local regulators, because they're actually employees, but the companies just call them independent contractors. So they're not union, no, but the union's been trying to organize them for some time, the Teamsters Union.
A variation on the gig economy?
Yeah, it's actually probably the first one of the first iterations of it, because it started back in the early 80s after the trucking industry was deregulated. These guys were kind of the original gig economy, if you will. But then I think what you were alluding to there was that it all sort of changed in 2008 when the Southern California new environmental rules banned old, dirty trucks. All these guys were driving clunkers, right, because they couldn't afford new clean trucks, so they were driving these 2-million-mile clunkers, spewing diesel into the air. And then finally, the city officials kind of got fed up, and they said, hey, listen, no more clunkers. So the companies kind of looked at each other, and they said, how are we gonna get new trucks for these guys? And that's what got us to where we are today.
And it only applies to trucking companies in Southern California?
The new environmental rules were pretty specific to L.A. Long Beach. Different versions of it rolled out in Oakland, so we're seeing similar things up there. Other ports are trying to implement kind of similar policies because the air around port cities is notoriously bad, and that's a lot to do with these trucks. So we're seeing different versions of it, yeah.
Isn't it surprising because California has some of the strictest labor regulations in the country?
Yeah, so what is interesting about this whole kind of setup is that it's a loophole in labor law, right? By calling these guys independent contractors, they don't have any de facto employee protections, which is what sort of a century of labor law is premised on, the employee-employer relationship. So by calling them independent contractors instead of employees, they don't have any of those rights. So they don't have a right to minimum wage. They don't have a right to organize like other employees would. And companies have been hoping that because they're independent contractors or because they call them that, then state regulators or even the court system won't be able to apply some of those strict labor laws you were referring to.
You profile Samuel Talavera Jr. in this story. Who's he and how did you meet him?
He's an immigrant from Nicaragua. Almost 90% of these guys are immigrants from Central and South America, all legal, documented immigrants who have to be to work there.
And let me interrupt you for a second. Is
sure.
The fact that they are, is that a factor because they don't speak English as well as some of the other people who might have gotten into the industry?
Yeah, it's a huge point. Most of these guys just have elementary school educations from their home countries, and they don't speak English pretty much at all. And when they were kind of handed these contracts back in 2008, when that environmental rule came into effect, they weren't translated. These contracts weren't translated. They weren't explained. But they were told by their employer, hey, listen, if you want to keep working for us, you need to sign this. A lot of guys weren't able to bring it home. They weren't able to have it translated. So they just needed to keep working. So they signed, and then the next day they kind of found themselves in debt, and it took almost weeks or months before they realized what had happened and how much they were in the hole.
And we're talking about poor truckers rather than long-haul truckers. Where do these people, these people pick up stuff at the port and then drive it locally?
Yeah, that's right. So they're not going over state lines. Usually it's just right from the pier to a warehouse or a rail yard nearby. And that can be, you know, anywhere between 5 and 50 miles. So these guys will do multiple turns a day, and they're not paid by hour or by the mile. They're paid by the container, how many containers they're able to turn. So they're kind of just working around the clock, doing these short local routes around the Los Angeles, Long Beach area.
Let's get back to Samuel Talavera Jr. What's his story? What happened?
So he used to be a legit small business owner. He had his own truck for years. He was driving it since he emigrated here. And then one day at his company, QTS, they told him, I think it was 2009 or 2010, Sam, you can't drive that truck anymore, but don't worry about it. We got a new one for you out back. And then he found out that if he wasn't working anywhere between 15 and 20 hours a day, he didn't have much of a prayer at covering the cost of that thing, because everything the company would normally pay for, you would think the company would pay for, was getting deducted right out of his checks. So that's the gas, that's the insurance, the lease payments, parking. Some companies have taken drug testing fees. One company was charging for the office toilet paper and office supplies. But Sam kept falling behind. He was working around the clock, but if work was slow, if he couldn't get enough containers, he fell behind. He ended up going bankrupt. He almost lost his house. And he, even though he lives almost or less than an hour away from the port, he sleeps in his truck almost every night. He's got a couple kids. He doesn't really see them because he's always in the thing, sort of his second home. And the truck drove him broke. And then one day, 4 years into his lease contract, so he was about a year away from what he thought was going to be the day when he finally paid it off, his truck broke down. His company wanted, I think it was like $2,000 of maintenance repairs. And he didn't have it. He couldn't afford it, so his company fired him, and then they kept the truck and the money he had paid into it. And it had been
$80,000.
That's the big question, right? Is any of this legal? It sounds like it isn't. And that's what a lot of lawyers and activists have been trying to make a case around. But again, they say, the companies will say he signed the contract, and then buried in these contracts, we went through more than a dozen of these things, buried in them are these clauses that sort of allow companies to fire a driver or to break the contract at the company's discretion. And then when they do that, they keep both the truck and anything they paid into it.
I'm speaking with Brett Murphy, an investigative reporter with the USA Today Network. He's written a story called Rigged that we are discussing. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You say this is a form of indentured servitude, and it kind of sounds like sharecropping. Is that really the right way to describe this situation? Are these people working for the company store?
You know, we brought our findings to quite a few experts, economists, labor experts, lawyers, and we said, you know, have you seen anything like this? What is it really here that we're looking at? And those were the comparisons we kept coming back to. It's a form of debt peonage, you know, no doubt about it. They have to pay in order to work. So even if they're working around the clock, it's likely that they're not actually turning a profit for take-home pay until Wednesday or even Thursday of that week. You know, the drivers know that, and so then they just keep working as a result, and the companies know that as well. It's you know, some of the more egregious cases we found were companies that sort of hang that debt over their driver's head, right? It's a kind of a cajole to make them work more, to make them take loads that are really low paying or not paying at all. Because if they don't, we saw a lot of instances of outright threats of punishments. And if a driver isn't able to work, if he doesn't get dispatched in retaliation, then he can go home with nothing. So it's just kind of constant economic threat looming over them on a day-by-day basis. Because if they don't work as much as they can, then it's possible they won't take anything home.
And what kinds of fees are these truckers paying? They're paying fees for the trucks, or are they paying off the cost of the truck so that they will own it somewhere down the line?
It's both of those things. So every week, a standard payment will come out as a lease payment, and that can range anywhere between I think I saw $250 and close to $500 a week, depending on the structure of it. And then on top of that is everything else, right? It's insurance, it's diesel, which can spike dramatically, it's parking fees, it's insurance, it's maintenance, it's sort of anything the company might look at as part of the truck's costs. So anything that might be considered overhead or equipment costs ends up coming out of their weekly checks, sort of nickel and dimed all over their checks. And the idea...
Even toilet paper, they're charged for toilet paper.
Yeah, that was one. That was one we saw. We had to kind of go burying or digging really deep into find out what exactly this $2 charge we kept seeing at this one company, Fargo Trucking, was, and it was for the office toilet paper and office supplies. We found a memo from the company owner to his drivers telling him he was going to start charging for that. Some of the company owners realized that they can pretty much shift all the overhead, the company's overhead, right onto the drivers just by deducting it from their checks.
Is there any other industry that you know that works this way?
There were some comparisons made to different gig economy industries now, so people will talk about Uber, but I don't think that, you know, we wrote a story about how that comparison doesn't hold very much water, because what's different about Uber is that you can leave, right? You can leave Uber. There's no stake you think you're building into the company or into the equipment you're driving. What I kept hearing from these guys, which was really unique about it, was that they didn't think they could quit, right? They said, listen, I've been paying into this thing for 3 years. There's $40,000 in it. My entire life savings is into this. We had to refinance our house, or we lost the house to foreclosure. We need to leave. Leaving for us is not an option, so we're gonna stay. A lot of them felt, you know, pretty trapped by the situation and by how much of their life savings had been tied into the truck, and that's pretty unique to this industry.
How many companies did you investigate?
So we know of 60 at least, and there's likely up to 140 maybe. That are all using a very, very similar model, and that's an accounting from both my interviews, companies I found at the California Labor Commission's office, and through the civil court system. So these companies have made appearances, at all different levels, and it looks to be pretty widespread and a pretty large share of the market down there.
Because it's so profitable?
It isn't so much that they're raking in, I think, a lot of money. There are certainly some companies that are, without a doubt, getting rich off of it. But what a lot of company owners explained to me is that they were between a rock and a hard place, right? It was 2008. This has been a historically deregulated industry. And then in 2008, suddenly this new environmental regulation drops on their head. They had never owned trucks before. These companies did not own trucks. They were just dispatching independent contractors, other small businesses. And then suddenly, with this new regulation, they had to own the trucks. They had to buy them and then figure out a way to have somebody else pay for them. That was sort of the whole model. And once a few companies figured it out, then it kind of spread like wildfire, as one company owner explained it to me. It's to play by the rules down there, or to do things the right way, would almost certainly mean that companies would lose a lot of business. They wouldn't be able to compete. It's hyper competitive. The margins are thin. So they explain it as sort of like a necessary evil and just the cost of doing business nowadays.
Since these truckers are leasing these trucks, can they just use them to deliver for anyone?
The company owners have tried making the case for years that they can, but what we found through all the testimonies we listened to and read through the contracts themselves is that it's near impossible for these guys to do that. Some dispatchers just patently denied them that right. If they tried to do that, they would. I saw one company threaten to call the police on drivers who went on unapproved routes. Other times it was more implicit. It was the insurance policy. So the company is providing them insurance, and that insurance only covers company-approved routes. Other times it was just written directly into the contract that you can't use this for other companies. And most drivers just understand that as part of the deal. You know, they're parking the thing in the company lot at night. It has the company's placards, you know, stickers on the side of it. They don't see it as an option for them to be moving and taking the thing around. And the company's at a lot of places made that very clear that this is not for you to be taking and shopping around.
You mentioned the deregulation of the trucking industries. Would the previous regulations have protected these drivers more?
Yeah, I mean, if you look before 1980, 1985, everything was a Teamster-run union shop. Everybody was a company driver, right? That's what they call employee drivers in the industry. So there were just a few very large companies. It wasn't very competitive. The barriers to entry were quite high. You had to have a lot of capital if you wanted to go into the trucking industry. So what you were seeing were companies and employees. Employees with fully protected rights, protected under Fair Labor Standards Act, under National Labor Relations Act. But what you have after that is after all those barriers to entry dropped, after retailers and importers can start price comparing, was a flood of the marketplace of a lot of these independent contractors. And this is in long haul, too. It's all over the industry where you had a lot of immigrants coming in, a lot of low-income earners, low-wage earners, coming in after they had been able to get financing for a $10,000 or $15,000 truck that they could, you know, squeeze a few miles out of and hopefully make a buck.
I'm speaking with Brett Murphy, an investigative reporter with the USA Today Network. We're talking about the story he uncovered that is headlined in USA Today, Rigged. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Brett Murphy, who's an investigative reporter for USA Today Network, talking about his story called Rigged. Where are these truckers delivering their cargo?
So they're really just bringing it to nearby warehouses. These are the containers, shipping containers. But once they get to those warehouses or the rail yards, they're unloaded and then brought all over the country. So even though these guys are doing just a kind of a short leg of the supply chain, it's really the first step. It's kind of the most important stateside elbow of the whole supply chain. And even though they're coming in through California, the stuff can end up on the East Coast, down south, pretty much all over the country. About half of America's imported goods come through these two ports alone. Anything manufactured in the Pacific Rim, you know, furniture, clothing, car parts, it's coming through these two ports.
Do the retailers whose cargo is being delivered know this situation involving the truckers?
Yeah, so that's a kind of a really good question. We're having a story come out this week, later this week, on that very question, looking at the retailers' role in all of this. You know, what we found through the reporting is that they either didn't know, they said they didn't know, or they said it was out of their hands and not their responsibility. These guys use contractors of subcontractors of subcontractors. It's a whole maze of third-party companies on the logistics chain. And they say, listen, you know, we have a supply chain code of ethics. We have standards. We expect everybody, all of our vendors, to adhere to the laws and to act accordingly. But it's not our role to be stepping in there and policing these places. They run audits. They tout their audits overseas at their manufacturing plants. They say that they check to make sure there's no instances of forced labor or unfair business practices happening there. But it looks like they haven't really standardized that stateside. You know, if you ask them what port trucking companies they use, a lot of times they won't know offhand, or they'll take weeks to figure it out. I found myself informing a lot of them about who was moving their goods. So it seemed to be something very new to them. I have to say, since we published our first story, I didn't get a flood of responses from retailers saying that they were going to look into it or anything like that. But we do have another story coming out this week that's exploring more deeply their role and how they've kind of monitored this whole thing.
We have a call from somebody who owned a trucking company. Richard from Dumont, New Jersey, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Back in the 60s, National Freight, Vineland, New Jersey, was involved in a suit with their owner-operators because they were leasing trucks to the owner-operators, and they were controlling their work and recalling the trucks when they didn't make their loans due. This has been adjudicated a long time ago.
And what was the result of the case of the lawsuit?
They had to get out of the business of doing that.
But, Brent, are there lawsuits in California that would that might come up with the same result?
Oh, yeah. So there's been large-scale litigation, both in civil court and in the State Labor Commission out there. And in each case, in 97% of the cases, I found the drivers were in the right. Those judges and hearing officers said, you were never an actual independent contractor because of this whole system. Even though the trucking company called you one and you signed something that said you were one, and even if you might think you're one, you're not. You're actually an employee. This is illegal for them to be calling you an independent contractor and charging you for this truck. But what is interesting is that it kind of stops there. They look at these things on a case-by-case basis. So even if driver A at a company is found to be a misclassified employee, that doesn't mean any of the other drivers have to be reclassified. So all they really award that guy is some back pay or penalties, but they don't go in and tell the company they have to change their ways. So even though there have been hundreds of these things that have come through, there's a lot of companies who are still using the same model, even though they've lost a lot of these cases.
Richard, you don't sound like you're surprised by the story that we're telling here.
No. Well, first of all, deregulation only deregulated ease of entry. Everything else was supposed to be enforced, including pricing. But if you don't enforce it, it doesn't exist.
And how was it finally resolved in New Jersey? Was it just New Jersey?
No. Well, it was in front of the ICC at the time, which doesn't exist anymore. But they had to stop the practice. Because this was on one of the very, very first shows of 60 Minutes. That's how far back this goes.
Well, I guess what everything that's old is new again. Thank you so much for calling us.
My pleasure.
Now, Brett, can you tell some interesting stories here? Can you talk about Reyes Costellas, another trucker you profiled?
Yeah. So Reyes is still at the company that we actually were writing about there. There weren't a ton of guys we talked to that were currently in the situation, right? A lot of them had left or had been fired already. But we found a good chunk who were still at the companies who were still willing to talk to us about what they were kind of going through. And Reyes was a tough kind of case. He had recently lost his house because he fell so far behind on it. He gave us a look at his tax returns, and they kind of read a lot like these guys' weekly checks do. They start with a gross amount. That's how much the Reyes would earn that week. And then after all deductions, they have sort of the net kind of settlement amount. And his yearly pay really reflects that. So I think he grossed somewhere in the 90,000s. And then after all of the expenses that the company had taken, it was close to, I think, $23,000. So it just kind of shows you how their pay can kind of plummet after paying all the costs of the truck. And what that means for Reyes is that it cost him his house, him and his wife his house. And another thing going on with Reyes is that he has really bad gallstones. And these guys, again, they're independent contractors. That means they don't get employee health benefits. And he hasn't been able to afford the doctor's appointments or the medicine to kind of take care of himself. A lot of these guys are diabetic as well, and a lot of them are struggling with their health because they can't afford to treat themselves. And that's, again, because they're not employees. They are independent contractors.
$90,000 wouldn't make him rich, and obviously losing all of that money, it puts him somewhere below the poverty line, doesn't it?
Yeah, out in California, if you're caring for enough people, I think if it's below $25,000 and you have and you're caring for three people, I believe that is below the poverty line, right? And he's taking care of his mother-in-law and his stepson.
What about Alfredo Arambula? Does he have a similar story?
Yeah, Alfredo was working for actually the same company as Reyes, and Alfredo had been paying into the truck for years. Really hard-working guy, older than most folks I spoke with. He didn't speak any English. He was a Mexican immigrant, I believe. And then one day he got hurt on the job. He was kind of running, and he slipped, or he got his foot caught, and he broke his foot, and he couldn't drive anymore, so he couldn't keep up with the payments on the truck. And then the company fired him, and they said, listen, you fell behind in the lease. We need to get somebody in this truck who can pay for it, so you can't work here anymore. So right now he's out of work. He didn't have much of a savings left over. You know, there's no severance or a pension or anything. So he was just sort of down and out and trying to scrape by on what he and his wife can put together. But like a lot of guys, you know, when they fire you, it means more than just getting fired. You had been living paycheck to paycheck to begin with because all of your savings were getting tied up into the truck, and with this hope or this promise that they were going to one day own the thing. So when you lose all of that, all of a sudden it can mean losing everything, and that's what happened to Alfredo.
Who's representing these drivers when they go to court?
A lot of guys. There's a lot of private attorneys in the L.A. Long Beach area that have taken these up. A small handful of them that I talked to over the course of the past year. The union, the Teamsters union, has been extremely active in these cases. They've been helping these guys file complaints, file lawsuits. They've been representing some of them in court. They've been picketing, trying to organize these guys. And what the company owners have done with that information is said, all of the accounts that I've pieced together, all of the things I've been hearing, are really overblown, sort of exaggerations, part of a union organizing campaign. So by having such an active sort of involvement, the Teamsters have sort of put themselves front and center in some cases, and it's one of the first things that the company, the industry side, will say to you.
What do the judges say about the classification of these drivers as independent contractors?
It's pretty much a non-starter in a lot of the cases. The fact that they don't own the trucks that they're driving, that the company is actually has their name on the registration and the title and their ownership, and yet they still dispatch the routes or dispatch the deliveries. So what most of the hearing officers and judges have said is that he didn't have the protections of an employee or the rights of an independent contractor. So he kind of had the worst of both worlds here. I haven't seen any cases where the judges or the appeals judge, some drivers have lost, but I think they've won appeals. But it's hardly ever the fact that you'll see these things siding with the company. It seems to be sort of a foregone conclusion at this point, which a lot of companies have pushed back against as well. They've said they're no longer looking at these as a case-by-case basis. They've just already made up their minds about us, about our workers, and we're kind of screwed because of it.
Well, how does the practice continue if the judges keep on ruling against the trucking companies?
You know, like I was saying, they're a case-by-case basis, every one of these things. So even if one guy can be ruled as an employee, not an independent contractor, that doesn't mean anybody else at the company shares that ruling. It's a federal law that no government agency, no state or local agency can regulate the business model of a company involved in interstate commerce. So because these guys are kind of protected under this federal preemption, there can be no sweeping sort of ruling or new regulation they fought against these of any sort of broad sweeping reforms inside the companies or across the industry.
Have any of the drivers been able to manage paying through their lease and owning the trucks?
Yeah, absolutely. And I met a handful of guys who were happy. They were happy with the opportunity the company had given them. They were happy with their new truck. And it's the first thing the company owners will say as well. You found a minority of guys who weren't happy with what happened to them, but we know of guys who are happy. And they say that the happy ones are the more diligent, hardworking men. But if you talk to the almost 1,200 drivers that I cataloged, they will not share that same sentiment.
Now, you mentioned that all of this was a result of new environmental regulations that took many of the older trucks off the road. Have the mayors of Long Beach and Los Angeles responded to your articles?
Yeah, I got statements from both of them right after the articles, and right after My first one, there was actually a strike as well. So the Teamsters went to both Mayor Garcetti and Mayor Garcia, L.A. and Long Beach, and they got statements as well. It's kind of more boilerplate stuff. You know, we need to protect the truckers just as much as we need to clean the air. We can't be just footing them with the bill. So they, you know, recently signed a pact to reach zero emissions by 2035 in L.A. Long Beach. So that means there's going to be a whole new crop of trucks that somebody's going to have to pay for. And what a lot of people are asking right now, what I'm asking right now, is, you know, who's going to pay for it? You know, that was left open-ended last time. The city of L.A. tried to write into that in 2008 that it couldn't be the drivers that paid for these things, but the trucking association sued L.A. in federal court, and they won, so that L.A. couldn't tell them that they had to use employee drivers. So that's still the same framework we're working on here. So a lot of people right now are asking the mayors, you know, what are you going to write in to protect these guys now? Now that we know what's the worst that could happen here, based on the reporting and based on what guys are saying about their current situation, a lot of folks are hoping that they do it differently, that they write in some protection to make sure that it's not the truckers who are paying for the new trucks.
We have just 15 seconds left, but you talk about these truckers working incredibly long hours. Don't the federal fatigue laws apply?
They should, but these guys skirt them. They doctor their logbooks. Their companies a lot of times show them how to do it. And as one trucker said to me, if you play by the rules, you don't eat. So really down there, there's no option.
Brett Murphy is an investigative reporter for USA Today Network. His article on the plight of these truckers in Los Angeles and Long Beach is headlined Rigged. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thanks so much for having me.